Howdy. Hi, friends. Greg Kokel here at Stand to Reason. And, you know, we didn't used to have the rooster in the second hour of broadcasting, but since both of these are kind of standalone recordings every week and podcasts, I thought it is a good idea. Thank you, Derek, for including our bird in each broadcast. It makes it sound just right as we started out. Greg Kokel here, of course. This is the show that turns your mind on. That's the way I like to think of it. And it also is a place where I give you a piece of my mind, and you can give me a piece of your mind. Or you can ask a question if you like. I mean, we do all kinds of stuff here. People do agree with me much of the time. Sometimes they disagree with me and give me the reasons. We knock it back and forth. Sometimes there's just an in question about some important issue, and people want to see, well, where do I stand and why do I stand there, which is great. So that's a lot of fun to do that. I've been doing it for – this is my 30th year. So that's great. Our number, if you want to call in, 855-243-9975. That's from 4 to 6 p.m. PT, Pacific time, on Tuesdays. That's when we do the main broadcasts. If you're international, and we occasionally get people from other countries. Once I had one day I had four continents represented. The number is 562. That's our Southern California area code. 424-8229 is the number. Now, I mentioned that sometimes I get questions where people are just trying to figure things out, and they're not sure where they stand. They've been raised one way, and they've had one view, and then they're exposed to another, and they got to work it out. And that's the case of Cade here in Minnesota. And Cade was on our last broadcast. I held him over because he has lots of good questions. And Cade, you're really fun to talk to. So
Thank you, Mr. Yeah. Kokel. I appreciate that.
Plus, you call me Mr. Kokel, and no kid call me that anymore. You know, that's great. Hey, old guy, you know, that kind of deal. No, anyway, you're very polite. I appreciate that. But
Thank you. You're welcome.
And I have to tip my hat to you because and to your parents, because you're raised with one point of view about the origin of the universe and creation and the time and age and all that of the universe and how that all worked out. And in the school that your folks sent you to, they had one point of view. And this was true with my daughters, too. They went to a classical school and they learned the young earth position. And that was just kind of more presumed, I think, than taught very much, but they did teach it a little bit. It was just straightforward to them. This is the way it is. And although they're not aggressively dogmatic in an unpleasant way, I mean, I was fully welcome at the table, even though that wasn't my view. And so it's never been a problem there. But having been raised in that and having your parents actually have a different point of view on that, you're kind of figuring things out for yourself, which is great. So I tip my hat to your parents for kind of giving you the intellectual freedom to work through this yourself rather than kind of leaning on you one way or another. So it seems like you have a lot of freedom, right?
Yeah. I don't know what I'd do if I didn't have my parents. They are so influential in my life.
Well, that's great. But it's what's really sweet at this point is just their willingness to give you the freedom to find out what you think the truth is of the matter for yourself. And this is why you're asking some of the questions. So the first question had to do with Big Bang cosmology. Just to review that for people who maybe didn't hear the last show, with Big Bang cosmology and how the Big Bang cosmology doesn't seem to fit with the order that we see in the book of Genesis there in the chapter one, because there seems to be a very specific order, and the sun shows up on the fourth day, etc. And according to that. But you don't have that kind of thing happening if you take this kind of approach that science does to the origin of the universe maybe 17 billion years ago and the origin of the Earth maybe 3.5 billion years ago. I mean, that just doesn't seem to fit the order there. And I talked about two ways of looking at it that have been offered by people who love the Lord and have a high view of Scripture. And one of them was Hugh Ross, who thinks the order is right, but there is a detail there about the position of the observer that influences how we read the text, and that is the point of view. The viewpoint is from the surface of the Earth, and according to his take on this, the atmosphere didn't clear up in order to be able to see the sun and moon until later. There was a primordial Earth situation. There was light because of the translucence of the atmosphere, but it wasn't transparent enough to see the sun and the moon. So that's a possible take. Some people say, well, I don't buy that. Well, that's okay. That's up to them. But I just want to make the point that there's an attempt to make sense of the text in a way that's consistent with what the science says and honor the text at the same time. And I think Hugh is quite persuasive, and apparently he's persuaded your parents. So the second thing is that the text is not meant to be a chronologue at all, that is a chronological series of events that took place, but it's meant to fulfill a different task. And so the people who hold that view take a non-concordist view, that there isn't a series of events that's taking place here, but it's a description, a larger, broader description of things that are happening. And that accounts for why you could have a morning and an evening with no sun. Or you could have a day with no sun, because these are figurative terms that are identifying something else. So anyway, that's as far as we've come, and you don't have to tell me whether that sounds persuasive to you or not. You're welcome to comment if you like, but it's something to chew on is all I'm giving you at this point.
I want to make sure I understand you. So basically what Moses, who is the supposed writer of Genesis, basically, what he's saying is there is what the creation days are supposed to represent is more of what someone from Earth, observing from Earth, would have seen, not so much as how God supernaturally observed it.
Well, I don't know that I would put it quite that way. And there you're reflecting Hugh Ross's view. I think what Hugh Ross would say. Okay, let me back up and use another illustration. So in the book of Ecclesiastes, right, we have a person talking about his view on life. All right. So the perspective of that writing is first person. That is, an individual is talking about what he sees. Okay, so that's the viewpoint perspective of that writing. Now we have other writings, though, where it's God talking, and so he can talk about what's happening at one place and then what's happening at another place. A person who's speaking in the first person can't say that, you know, because he's not in that other place. Okay, so what I'm saying is, in literary pieces, one has to establish the viewpoint perspective or viewpoint character in order to understand what's going on around you. And what Hugh Ross says is the perspective offered is not the perspective of Moses or a man or even of God, but it's the literary perspective that is captured in Genesis 1, where the text says that the Spirit was brooding on the surface of the water. And so now we know the viewpoint is on the surface, the argument goes. Viewpoint is down on the surface of the water, the surface of the earth. And then everything that develops from that is seen from that perspective. That's what he was suggesting. God is still God. He sees everything. You know, he knows. But the way the writing is positioned, it is meant to tell us who the viewpoint character is, the Spirit on the water, and that everything we are to understand developing from that position of viewpoint, not from way out in outer space looking at the earth, but from the perspective of some fictitious person, if you will, or the Holy Spirit, however,
on
the surface of the earth. That's the way that explanation
that makes
works.
A lot more sense.
Yeah, thank you. I hope that's clear.
So the second one is, so there's a lot of controversy over this. So I read a lot of, when I researched, I read a lot of from the Answers in Genesis website. And so what few of the scientific evidence they give for a young Earth is, I'll give two because they kind of are coherent with each other, is salt. If there was billions of years, then there would be much more amounts of salt in the ocean. Uh-huh. And if there had been billions of years, there would be much more sediment at the bottom of our oceans.
Okay, well, I know how to answer the second one, but not the first, but they're similar. And because I have read about these things before, I just can't call them to mind. A lot of times when you get an explanation like that, you only get part of the information. And let's just – so I can't tell you about the salt, but I can, Hute deals with that. But I can tell you about the sediments, okay? The surface of the earth is not static. In other words, the surface of the earth does not stay in one place. The surface of the earth moves around, okay? So things...
Plate tectonics.
Plate tectonics, exactly. And I think it's a pretty well-verified geological fact. The plates move around.
Oh, yeah. Even the young earthers use it.
Yeah. Well, okay. With that in mind, then, wouldn't it make sense? Wouldn't it be an explanation of the sediment problem? Okay, everything decays, right? Everything erodes. It all goes into the pond, into the oceans. We got flatlands everywhere, and all the silt is in the ocean. Well, all things being equal, but all things aren't equal. Those surfaces are moving around, and one gets shoved up on top of the other. And so what used to be a mountain and became silt in the bottom of the ocean now is a mountain again. That's plate tectonics. In fact, in Southern in Southern California, you can see this real easily. You can actually see where the strata of Earth is thrust over. And so it's shooting like a strata, like a sandwich-like thing. It's got layers, you know, like a Napoleon cake or whatever they call that. You know what I'm talking about. You see the side of it's sick, sticking up at an angle. It's going up over another thing. You can see the stratification of the layers that were laid down now sticking up, okay? And I know you're up, of course, you're up in glacier country, you know. A lot of the geologic formations there north of Minneapolis has been formed by the glaciers. But so that's a little different dynamic. But still, nevertheless, you have this earth that has fallen down by gravity and eroded by wind and all that gets moved around by other forces, whether it's a glacier or whether it's plate tectonics. So the surface of the earth is not static, and therefore we wouldn't expect the oceans to be filled with silt. Now, here's what troubles me about that argument. You understand the explanation, right?
Yeah.
Does it make sense to you?
Yeah, so basically what you're saying is that the moving surfaces moved around the sediment, so we can't expect them to just stay in one place.
Exactly. If the mountain wears down into sediment into the ocean, but then you have plate tectonics pushing one plate over the other, that sediment sediment is going to go up and make another mountain. And this is why you can go on the top of mountains and find seashell fossils.
And sea fossils, too.
Exactly, of course. You know, I mean, but see, this is so obvious. It's not even controversial. And since it's, I don't mean to be critical here, but I'm just going to make an observation. Since it's obvious and it's not controversial that this thing takes place, then why does somebody advance the argument for a young Earth based on sedimentation that would have taken place if the Earth was older? It wouldn't have.
Okay.
I mean, it's obvious to everybody that that wouldn't have been the case because of plate tectonics. So why is that being put forward? And I think there's a similar kind of thing with salt, although I can't give you the details, and you'd have to go.
I think that would be very similar.
Yeah. So, but the explanation is it's the same kind of argument, but the explanation of why it doesn't apply is going to be different. And that's why I encourage you to maybe talk to your folks. They probably know the answer to that one because Hugh Ross deals with it. And I've seen a lot of arguments like that, that just when you look more closely at them, they don't hold up. They don't make the point that the young Earth creationist thinks or is advancing it to make. And this is one of them. So, I mean, the sedimentation one. So what's our next step? How are we doing?
It's been great so far.
Okay.
Light bulbs going off everywhere.
I heard them popping, man, all over here in Los Angeles.
So the next one is, so if the old Earth position is true, then how can there be death before Adam? Because apparently the Bible is very, very clear that death and sin entered the world when Adam and Eve sinned in the Garden of Eden.
Okay, and where does it actually talk about that?
When they eat from the fruit, I think the Bible talks about that the ground will be cursed because of them, and the thorns.
Okay.
The thorns start there, and that's when God says that well, they'll surely die.
Okay.
That's the prophecy.
Sure. Okay, let's talk about that. That's actually not the main text, but it is one that comes into play. So let's just talk about it. He said, the day that you eat thereof, you shall surely die. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. When they ate it, did they die physically? Did they fall over dead?
No.
Okay, so he's referring to something else than just dropping over dead. Okay?
Yeah, he's saying that their bodies will decay and
right.
eventually die.
Okay, whose bodies?
Adam and Eve and all the humans.
There you go. Exactly. It's making a statement about human beings there, not the rest of the world. I mean, to be fair, it doesn't say anything about that. It's making reference to humans. Now, the curse that comes afterwards that you mentioned does talk about difficulty that will happen, but it's toil that is added to man's work and toil to women's childbirth that's added, not death. It's not mentioned there, just the reality of toil. And that's a real problem, but he's not talking about death there. So the only time he talks about death is that death sets in eventually in human beings for having sinned. And then when you go to Romans 5, which is the more popular passage dealing with that issue, it goes into more, in a sense, theological detail. In Romans 5, we have a very similar kind of situation. That is where Paul is describing the introduction of death through sin into humanity. Verse 12, Romans 5. Therefore, just as through one man sin entered into the world and death through sin, and so death spread to all men. It doesn't say that death spread to everything that was alive. It says death spread to all men.
Okay.
And that's so throughout then, through this text, that's the same situation.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. And then I think the second half of that is, and Ken Ham and one of his astrophysicists, his name is Jason, I think, Lisley.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. Mm-hmm. But they say their fossil records show that there was cancer and there was thorns. If there were billions of years, then why would God have made cancer and thorns? Because, and the Jason does this a lot, he'll say, we worship a God who is good, and he made paradise for us. He didn't make cancer and thorns and all that.
Well, let me just talk. I don't know about the cancer part because I can't speak to that. There are all kinds of organisms that God made that in the context of human beings, since the fall, create problems. But they weren't problems necessarily before, okay? So I don't know what cancer he's talking about, okay? Certainly he's not talking about human cancer because he's looking at cancer in the fossil record, but that's just animal.
No, animal cancer.
Okay, that's what I mean. In the fossil record with animals. Okay, so what? This is a different kind of argument. This is the kind of argument that says, I cannot believe that a God would make a world in which there would be suffering for animals, like through cancer. That's exactly what's at question, whether God, and I asked a young earther about this once before, so animals feel pain. Yes. I said, did God design that? He said, yes. Because that's the only answer. That's the only answer. The pain is a sophisticated, reaction
to
things.
And it's a way to help
us. And it's, yes, exactly. It's a warning system. It can go crazy. It can go awry, but it's a good thing, not a bad thing. So if God makes pain, then pain serves a valuable purpose. And what happens is that some people are saying, oh, I think pain is bad. Well, look, if God made pain, then it's not bad. It's not fun, but it's not bad. And so I just want you to see the nature of this argument is, well, I believe in a perfect God, and he makes a perfect world. And here's what a perfect world looks like to me. No pain or no cancer. Well, what's the problem with cancer? It's another organism. What, did the fall make a cancer? Did the fall make a cancer virus or whatever it is? The fall isn't creative. It's destructive. Now, just to go to the other point— And that is the point about the thorns. I do not think that thorns came into existence at the fall. I don't think that thorns came into existence at the fall. Thorns are features, are design features of plants, and there's a gazillion plants that have them. All right? And they're okay. Sophisticated. They're part of the genetic structure. Okay? So did somehow the fall create all of those things? No, God did that. Well, I do think God did that. But I think what's...
And it's also kind of a defense system for the plants, isn't it?
Pardon me?
It's kind of a defense system for the
plants
as well. Yeah,
it seems to be, you know, possibly, that God ordained or whatever. But, I mean, I was out pulling weeds the other day, and I got all kinds of burrs over me, and they didn't feel good. But the thing that was – but they were serving a good purpose because I'm transporting these burrs to other places so they can propagate, right? I think what's going on in Genesis 3 is not the invention of thorns, but the acknowledgement that now man's labor – is going to be it's going to be foiled, man. It, foiled by, I don't want to make a joke. Toil, man's labor turns into toil. In other words, what he used to be able to do for fun, now it's going to be work. And the thing that makes it work is a whole bunch of circumstances that work against him. So I don't feel I'm required to say that. That thorns were invented. In fact, it does, at the fall. In fact, it doesn't even say this. It says, "Cursed is the ground because of you. In toil, you will eat of it all the days of your life. Both thorns and thistles, it shall grow for you."
For the human.
Well, yeah, but I'm saying my point is, the focus isn't that I'm just inventing something new to harass you. That isn't what God's saying.
Yeah.
He's saying, now when you try to do it, you're going to run into this opposition, and thorns and thistles are part of it. He doesn't say that thorns...
And that's not so much of what happened beforehand.
Right. Thorns and thistles weren't created at that moment. They were there before. They just weren't creating a problem. I mean, that's the way I'm going to take
it. Yeah, that totally makes sense. And then the other thing is that God didn't intend for this world to be perfect. He wants the next earth to be perfect. This earth... was because he knew that we would fall. This earth was for us to fall and then Jesus to come and save us, and then he'll make a new earth and a new heaven.
Well, that's a very profound thought, and it's there's a lot of substance to that and a lot of truth to that. I don't know how it all plays out. You know, I mean, the word perfect is one of those words that has a definition depending on who you're talking to. So to young earthers, a perfect world is one that doesn't have any cancer critters and doesn't have any pain for critters. So, but that's not the world that God apparently made. So I think that's a weak point, though it does have appeal for some people.
Yeah, I know that's one of Ross's arguments. So, and it made sense that this earth is not supposed to be the perfect one.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and the young earthers, they've said to me, well, I believe in a God that is, he doesn't make painful things, and you believe in a God with bloodshed and death and all that other stuff. Well, the question is, what kind of world did God make? And if God made a world where things died prior to the fall— well, then that's not a bad thing. It's not fun, but it's the world God made. And if you look at the ecosystem, now this is another angle to this, Cade. If you look at the ecosystem is very, very sophisticated. And it's very, very interwoven, and they call it the balance of nature in a balanced kind of way. And this is a design feature. So I'm out years ago. I was taking a jog back when I could still run. And I'm running through this woods or whatever, and I see a dead animal, like a dead rabbit or something laying on the ground, or a squirrel or something. Been dead for a couple of days. You know, it's starting to dry out and get bony and everything, but it looked like it was moving. And so I stopped to take a closer look. And when I took a closer look, what I noticed is the appearance of movement wasn't the animal, but all the things that were eating the animal. And I counted about six different types of things. There, you've got larvae in there of some kind. You've got flies on it. You have beetles that are eating things. You've got ants that are digging around. Probably a crow came by and took a couple pecks at it. What was going on? This is God's garbage removal machine.
Yeah.
And so all of these critters are very what's the word, are designed in a very sophisticated way to get rid of dead things.
That makes total sense.
Yeah. I mean, so doesn't it look like God made a world where things die and had a whole bunch of things that eat those things that die? I mean, that's just one example. If you think about...
He had purpose for some of that.
That's right. These are all design features. And another thing to think about is think about spiders. Spiders spin very sophisticated webs with very, very strong material. And they have, and they do it, they don't think about it. They do it as an instinct. So if you broke off a piece of that web, it would keep repairing the web as long as you broke it off. It'll just keep doing it over and over and over until it fell over dead. Okay, it's because it's almost, they call it fexish behavior. It's almost automatic. But not because he's thinking about it and he figured out how to do the engineering. It's because God, that's a design feature in it. But what is he building the web for?
Yeah.
He's not building the web to catch a peach. He's building, right? He's building the web to
yeah.
catch another critter. And and you've seen them, you know, we're guys, right? We watch this stuff and we cheer them on, you know, get them. Something flies into the web and there it jumps. I used to have these big garden spiders back in Chicago when I was a kid, and I had boxes of them because I collect them, you know. And then we'd let them build their web, and then we get grasshoppers and toss them in the web and watch the spider do his job, spinning, and then injecting poison with a hypodermic needle. Okay.
Yeah, I can see how boys would do that.
Yeah, that's right. But notice not only the mystery of God making boys that way, but look at the mystery of what God made spiders that way. He made spiders.
I definitely see the point.
Yeah, with sophisticated equipment in order to kill other things and eat them. And there's a gazillions of examples of such a thing. Anyway, so we've covered some ground here. I got Victor in Portland, Oregon. Has been very patient waiting, but it's been we haven't gone to commercial because I've enjoyed talking with you so much, Cade. So,
well, thank you, Mr. Kokel. It makes total sense, and you've helped me so much.
Well, thanks, and give my best to your folks, and I hope we can talk again.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Kokel. Stay safe.
Okay, you too, buddy. Bye bye now.
Bye.
Well, that was sweet as usual. All right. Victor will be with you in a few moments. Let's go to break and then come back and talk with Victor in Oregon about his question. Greg Kokel here at Stand to Reason.
Some people treat Christianity like it's a build-your-own Sunday shop. They include the bits they like and exclude the bits they don't. The problem is, truth is not ice cream. You can't build your own biblical reality like you build an ice cream sundae. You can't pick and choose the parts you prefer. Truth doesn't work like that. Truth is what matches up with reality. Sadly, there are some who are creating a version of Christianity that fits their own subjective desire rather than sound doctrine. At this year's STR Reality Conferences, you will get the tools to identify counterfeit versions of Christianity so you can guard against them. We want to show you that biblical reality isn't something we shape. Rather, it's something that shapes us. So join us at one of this year's STR Reality Conferences. Discover why truth is not ice cream by visiting realityapologetics.com and registering today.
You can take Stand to Reason with you through our mobile apps, available for free from the App Store or the Google Play Store. The Quick Reference app gives you short, easily accessible courses on our most popular topics like tactics, homosexuality in the Bible, morality, the story of reality, and many more. The Stand to Reason app has all our latest content available at your fingertips. You can listen to our podcasts, check the blog, and access timely and practical resources. They're free, so download the apps today on the App Store or the Google Play Store and start carrying Stand to Reason with you everywhere you go. If you enjoy our apps, you can help other people find them by rating them on the App Store or the Google Play Store.
Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason, final segment here, I think. And before I go to Victor, I'll be there in just a moment. Vic, oh, buddy, just want to, I made a comment earlier when I was talking, we were talking about the creation, etc. And what troubles me sometimes with responses, if a person advances an argument to try to persuade somebody and they know that the argument has been answered, like, for example, the sedimentation thing, why is it continued to be advanced? If I knew an argument against some other view that I don't hold, and then somebody answered it and said, well, that works this way, so it ain't necessarily so that this works in your favor, well, I'd have to abandon that, not just keep peddling that same challenge out. Anyway, okay, that's all I'll say about that. It just troubles me. And Victor in Portland we go. Victor, you are Mr. Patient today.
Yeah, no problem, Greg. Can you hear me okay?
I sure can.
Oh, great. I got a headphone on it. I just make sure it works.
No, yeah, it's great. Thank you.
It's really, it's really great to talk to you. I've been listening to you for a long time on the radio. Mm. I really appreciate your ministry.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And I know you don't often, bring this up, but I, my wife and I have been supporters of Stand to Reason for many years now.
Wow.
And I just like to encourage anybody out there to, if they benefit from this ministry, especially, and I like how you say, if you feel led to, or even if you don't feel led to,
that's right.
Support Stand to Reason.
Yeah, that's right. You don't need God's permission.
A good ministry.
Oh, very good. Nicely put.
Yeah,
thank
exactly.
You. Thank you for your support, and your partnership. Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you, Victor.
Yeah, it's great to learn from you all these years. So, anyway, my question, and I also did want to mention real quickly that, I'm sad for the Ravi Zacharias ministry and people out there. I mean, sad in the sense that, we lost a great Christian man, but I'm excited for him. He's up with Jesus now.
That's
so
right. That's
he's
right.
Not,
he's in a better place than we are. Yeah.
Yeah. But, my heart goes out to all the ministry. And
right.
Appreciate that you had Abdu Murray on there today. But
it was great to have him. It was a real gift, and I actually didn't think it was going to work out. Amy said, should we have Abdu on? And I said, well, give him a call and tell him we're sorry for even asking because we know he's going through a lot and being right at the top of the organizational ladder of the organization, RZIM. But he said, no, thank you. It's an honor to do it. I'll be there. So we were fortunate that way.
Yeah, he seems like a great guy too. Anyway, my question is one that I'm having a difficult time framing or coming up with how to exactly ask it. So I'll do my best to try to put it forward and hopefully it'll make sense. So my thinking is kind of like, this is an analogy, like if you're going to sit down and play like a card game or a board game with somebody, there's rules that you agree to.
Right.
Otherwise, who wants to play with somebody who doesn't play by the rules or cheat?
Right.
And I guess in talking with people about, religious things, I run into people who seem to be more kind of the leftist or progressive mindset that, it's not so much about truth, but it's more about their feelings and that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
And I'm wondering your thoughts on when talking with somebody like that, do you think it's a good strategy to try to bring that issue up, that the reason why I'm advocating for my position is I'm trying to get at the truth, and I want to hear their reasons for why they believe the opposite, not just talk about each other's feelings.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to get to the truth and try to get them to agree with that. But a lot of them are resistant to this concept of there being objective truth and that being, even like Abdu Murray's book where he talks about, to think that you know the truth is like arrogant nowadays.
Yeah. Yeah,
and to be confused is actually a virtue in our culture now. So anyway, does that question make sense?
Yeah, it does. And there are a lot of people that you run into like that, and not just, you said broadly progressive types, and also those who consider themselves progressive Christians, and they are not following, in a certain sense, the dictates of Christianity as to what the Scripture has classically been understood to say, but they're following kind of their feelings. And, I don't like that part. I like this part. So that's the arbiter, what they like and what they don't like broadly. And, of course, this is dangerous because You know, our likes and our dislikes don't tell us what is true and what is false. And of course, this is the kind of conversation we want to have with people. What is true? And a lot of people have just gotten it into their head that there's no way you can know any truth about religion. You can know it about, like, gravity, but you can't know it about God. It's just a long shot.
Right.
So, you know, I should say not a long shot, but a crapshoot. You know, you give it your best shot and hope you get it right, kind of thing. Okay, so so I just thought of a couple different things. One thing is, if what they're doing is explaining their view, and then you say, well, how would you know that, or what are your reasons for that? And they say, well, I just feel it's that way. Then the question that could be asked, this is where you might want to introduce a counterexample. And essentially the tactic here is taking the roof off, because we're going to say implicitly, we're going to say, okay, following your feelings is the right way to figure out what's true for you. So then we give a clear case example. Excuse me. A lot of noise in the background there. I don't know what that is. Can you hear that?
I don't know either.
Okay.
No, I'm sitting inside my car, but I'm not moving. I'll put on mute, see if it helps.
No. Okay, thank you. It must be, yeah, whatever it is. Thank you for doing that. It's much better. And so people may, what we're going to try to do is kind of take their view seriously, like, okay, well, whatever you feel is true, that's what's true. And then give a counterexample of somebody whose feelings about truth turn out to result in really bizarre behavior. I'm trying to think right off the top of my head, some religious view maybe. You know, in India, when people died, when husbands died, their wives were burned alive with them at their funeral pyre. It's called sati, till the British put an end to the practice. And, of course, the people said, well, we have a tradition, and the tradition is that we burn the wife when the husband dies. And the British magistrate said, we have a tradition too, and the tradition is we kill people who do that. So one tradition versus another kind of thing. But notice the attempt there is just to show, well, this is clearly crazy. They believe that we should – what if we decided that in this country a group of people said, okay, here's our belief about religion. When the husband dies, the woman gets burned alive. And that's their belief. So what would you, the person you're talking to, say to that? I'm just curious, given that your view is you follow your feelings. So, I mean, that's one possibility. So just in general, take the roof off by giving a clear case counter example. The other thing is, and I'm not exactly sure, I had one other thought now, and I lost my train of thought regarding it, but I'm just – sometimes it mystifies me. I understand how people want to follow their feelings, but I think part of the reason is – oh, here it comes – that they're not convinced that anything could be known in the religious realm anyway, and so the only thing you have is to follow your feelings, okay? And so this might be a place to give an argument that is meant to show – that one could be confident of knowledge about some spiritual thing. And the simplest argument that I know to give at this point is the Kalam cosmological argument. I mean, it's known by that, but it's a simple argument, and it has to do with the origin of the universe. And I use a couple of different questions to lead up to it. You know the Kalam, is that right?
Yeah, I'm aware of that one.
Okay.
I forget how you put it. But like a big bang needs a big bang.
There it is. That's the simplest way to put it. A big bang needs a big banger. Exactly. Because everybody pretty much believes that the universe banged into existence. So then I just have a simple question. And I ask the person involved here. So do you think that everything that exists always existed, or did it come into existence? Oh, I think it came into existence. When? Well, it all started at the big bang. Okay, good. Now I have another question. I agree with you on all that, I'd say to them. And I say, now I got one other question. This is the real important one. What caused the Big Bang? And I'll make it real simple for you. You have two options, either something or no thing. Something or no thing. Now, it just strikes me as pretty obvious that the odds-on favorite is something rather than no thing. Okay? The idea of the universe just blasting into existence without any cause, for no reason, strikes me as not only absurd, but contrary to my entire human experience. And theirs as well. We don't see things just popping into existence here and there. Honey, where'd that new Mercedes SL come from in the garage? Oh, darling, that just popped into existence out of nothing. You know, that's the way the universe started, you know, so I don't know why it can't happen to a car. Now, no wife is going to
believe
that. Yeah, no wife is going to believe that, right? So it's not the odds-on favorite. Okay, so if it turns out that the no thing caused the universe is not the smart answer, then the smart, reliable answer is that something caused. And it turns out, when you think about it, it's not just going to be something, it's going to be someone, because it has to be the kind of thing that can initiate behaviors, take an action, make something happen, and that's a person. Have to be pretty smart, pretty powerful, you know, and pretty close. And so what you can do is you can, just from the observation that the universe came into existence, you can come to a conclusion that is roughly a profile of the kind of God we believe in. And so if that sounds reasonable to the person, okay, remember I'm just offering this as an example of religious knowledge. If that sounds reasonable to this person, then it's reasonable to say that you can actually know something about the spiritual realm, for one, that God exists, because of the argument you just offered. So in both cases, you're giving kind of an example of something. And I don't know if this is going to work. I'm just telling you this off the top of my head. It isn't like I've got a silver bullet here. But on the one hand, if the person thinks, well, feelings are what tells you what's true, and that's all you can do. And so you say, well, what happens when people have these feelings about what's true and this is what they do? So you're going to be in favor of that because that's their truth, right? Well, they'd have to be, unless they're going to say, no, they were wrong, and actually wrong, like Seti burning the wife. Another way of doing the example is say you can know something. It's not just a matter of feelings or just a crapshoot, but you can know something, and you could think through it a little bit and come to conclusions that are reliable. And the cosmological argument based on the Big Bang needs a big banger is an example of that kind of thing. So those are two lines of attack or approach. Attack's not the right word, but two lines of reasoning or approach is a better word, where you can maybe address this circumstance with someone else and see what happens.
Okay.
What do you think?
Yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah, I think that kind of that makes sense to bring up a more of a clear case, easy to understand example or argument that maybe they can start going, oh, okay.
Yeah, you kind of want to jolt them a little bit back to reality.
Yeah, sometimes I'll talk to people and it's like you bring up something and it's like they don't even want to you try to ask a question to see what they think or why they think that and they don't have like good reasons. That it's like the reasons don't even come into the picture for them. So anyway,
that
helps to come up with more of like, let's talk about something that's clear to agree upon here.
I'll tell you what's going on a lot of times, Victor, is they just don't care. Okay, that's just part of it. They just don't care.
Unfortunately.
You know, it's just the way it is. You know, so I'm, I don't mean to be condescending to anybody. I'm just saying a lot of people just, all right, well, whatever. You know, and they're in a stage in their life where it just doesn't matter that much. And those are the kind of people, you know, if they don't want to talk, I won't talk to them. You know, I'll just move on. Maybe there'll be another more opportune time. All righty?
Yeah, makes sense.
Hey, Victor, thank you for being a partner with us at Stand to Reason. And tell your wife hi and tell her I said thanks too. Okay?
Yeah, thank you, Greg. I appreciate your time.
All right, buddy. Take care. Bye.
So
I think we'll go to one more break and then to our final caller here on Stand to Reason. Stay with us.
Are you looking for a way to be more involved in the STR community? When you choose to support Stand to Reason with a monthly gift of $10 or more, you become a strategic partner in the work of equipping Christian ambassadors. Your monthly commitment makes you a part of a special group helping STR-trained Christians to graciously defend classical Christianity and classical Christian values. Your monthly gift helps us plan and manage STR's resources and provides consistent support to aid our planning and ongoing work. As a strategic partner, you'll enjoy an automatic 10% discount in our online store, access to a private Facebook group, and bi-monthly insider updates, so you'll get the inside scoop on what's going on in the ministry, and you'll know what you can pray for. Become a strategic partner in the Stand to Reason community today by visiting str.org/donate. Click How Often Will You Donate and choose Monthly. For personal assistance, you can email ocean@str.org. That's ocean@str.org.
You know, if you've gained anything from listening to Stand to Reason, I'd really be thrilled to hear it from you. I love to take your questions, of course, but I also want your feedback. So here's what you can do. Head over to iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts and leave us a rating and a review. That kind of thing really helps us to get the word out so more ambassadors for Christ can find the show and become equipped to stand confidently. And you never know, I might just give you a shout out on the air to show you my appreciation for your positive review. I value you as a faithful listener. I look forward to reading what you think about the show. Thanks. All right, final segment here on Stand to Reason with Greg Kokel and my guests as I come up on the phone here. I just got a note from Amy that when I was talking about the reality conference coming up in October in the Seattle area, that the city it's in is Bellevue, okay? And I don't know if I mentioned that last hour or this hour, but there you have it. So we're going to be in Bellevue, which is somewhere around Seattle, as I recall. All right, with that correction in place, let's go to Al in Dallas. Hello, Al.
Hey, Greg, thanks for taking my call.
Sure, glad to.
I'd like to get your advice on a recent situation that my wife and I found ourselves in which I discovered that she has been smoking THC in a vape form for the past couple months, which obviously was really off-putting to me at first, but a little historical background is she does suffer from pretty extreme PTSD. She carries high anxiety, deep depression, insomnia, and she's in therapy. She's taking medication. The only thing to seem, that seems to help her is this. And, you know, I'm trying to be faithful in my conviction, while at the same time sympathetic to what she's going through. And I'm not too sure how to navigate these waters.
Yeah.
So I'd like to get your thoughts.
Sure. And THC is the active component in marijuana, as I recall from my hippie days. and of course, in many states now, it's legal. Let's see, you're in Dallas. Is it legal in Texas to smoke marijuana?
It is not.
It is not. What about medicinal marijuana?
No.
Not at all. Okay, well, she, just so I'm clear, is she smoking marijuana or is she ingesting a THC, which is available in a legal fashion?
Exactly. She vapes, and so she tried the CBD, the non-THC CBD vape, and had no effect.
Uh-huh.
And then she moved on to the THC laden vape oil, I guess it is.
Uh-huh. So that is available commercially, THC vape.
It is, but I'm not sure the legality of THC vape in Texas.
Yeah. Okay. Well, my general view, I'm gonna make a dual statement here, or approach it from two different angles, and first the medical side, then the policy side. Okay. I have no problem with highly addictive drugs being used in a medicinal way as a controlled substance. So I think opiates, they have a place. Morphine, heroin, opioids, all of these things are medicines that get abused. But when they're used as medicines by an appropriate caregiver, that's fine. It's okay to take morphine when you're in deep pain and you're in the, as a palliative, as a pain controller, you know. The doctor gives it to you and you take it. And usually that's given to people that are dying in heavier doses. But in any event, there's certainly a legitimacy today. And by the way, whether it's an opioid or whether it's an opiate or whether it's THC, if there are medicinal values to them, then they can be used, in my view, in a way for those medicinal purposes. Okay. I mean, all things being equal, all of these things are illegal to use by private people, but they are legal when prescribed by a doctor. So there are controls that are involved there. Okay. And that's fine. I don't have a problem with that. Now, the problem with the difficulty with THC, though, is THC is the active ingredient of marijuana, and there's a whole culture who is just bonkers on marijuana as a recreational drug, not as a medicinal drug. Okay, I know this isn't the case with your wife, but I'm just talking more generally now, as a recreational drug. And so for years, even when I was in high school in the 60s, they were trying to get marijuana legalized. Okay, and they finally were able to do it in state after state after state. Okay, unfortunately, in one sense, that the marijuana of the 60s is not the same as the marijuana of the 2020s. This is much more sure. volatile, much more dangerous, okay? And so it doesn't function as a mere recreational drug. It's devastating in a lot of ways, and there's a lot of research that's been done on this. And some research, by the way, let's see if I have the book title here. I'll look for it. Some have effects on the psyche, that is.
I did read that. Yes.
Extended marijuana use causes mental illness, okay? Psychosis, correct. In some cases, and it's very well documented. Okay, I can't footnote it here, but just saying, that's something you can check out on. So these are additional problems to this particular thing. Now, I think marijuana has been legalized under the guise of being a medicine for recreational users. Because if it was really legalized as a medicine, then it would be in the apothecary would have it, you know? I'd go to CVS with a script, and then they give me my marijuana for whatever it is that ails me. The doctor thinks that would serve it. But instead, it's all a whole different system so that all kinds of people can get their marijuana legally because it's a medicine. Nonsense. Distribute medicine as medicine if, in fact, that's a legitimate use of that thing. So that's the political side that bugs me. Now, in your wife's case, it looks like she does have a genuine, from what you said, medicinal need for that thing. And she has and it's having a genuine salutary effect, at least initially. I don't know about the legality of what she's doing, vaping with THC right now. I don't know in the state of Texas, and that'd certainly be a factor if she is doing something illegal, taking an illegal medication in an illegal way. That needs to be addressed. But if she's taking a legal medication that is some kind of – it has the mind-altering capabilities like all the rest of them, you know, that are being used for pain or whatever, then if she's doing it under the care of a doctor – then I'm fine with it, just like any other drug.
Both her psychiatrist and psychologist know she's on it, and they actually think it is a benefit to her. Mm-hmm. Just for the record,
yeah. Well, if that's the case, then I don't have a problem in principle. But that does raise the difficulty if it's illegal for anybody to use that medication under any circumstance. And now then she's a follower of the law, and that's a factor. Okay. So if the law is such that if your psychiatrist, who is a doctor anyway, and your attending medical physician, give the green light on it, then I think that it's okay. given that it's illegal, then you're doing it truly for medicinal purposes. But you, with any medication, you have to be aware of the downsides of that medication. And some medications, they're careful about how they give them out. I take Xanax, for example, with some regularity, but you got to be careful because it's habit forming, right? I take a very, very low dose when I need it. But anyway, you got to be careful. And so they don't want to give out too much because it'll be bad for you. And THC, from what I know, has a lot of negative effects that people have that the press hasn't reported because it's a popular drug with the left. And so they're not going to tell you the truth about these things, but the material is out there, as you've noted, that might that tells you more about the problems, right? So that's something else to keep in mind.
Well, but as it stands, we've kind of left it to where she knows principally I'm against it, but I'm sympathetic to her suffering, and ultimately, I've compromised and said, you know, you can go ahead and I won't give you any, you know, crap about it.
Yeah.
As long as you're not doing it while our son's under your care or driving machinery. And as long as you're working towards finding a way to get off of it.
Yeah.
And so we'll work on that into the future until something happens.
Uh-huh.
But, the point you raise about the legality, I guess, I'm going to go ahead and assume that it's not legal because her therapists have not prescribed it.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
that's probably why. And I guess that leads into a further discussion of
It's another part
how
of
we
the
handle
thing.
That.
And then
she really does suffer, you know.
Yeah. Well, I've got it. Sometimes what you have is you have what's called a moral dilemma, and where you have one obligation that competes with another.
Right.
You know, I mean, yeah, most people are going to break the speed limit if they're taking their wife to the hospital who's delivering a child. You know, and so sometimes those are factors that one has to take into consideration given a potential moral dilemma. I'm not advising you one way or another. I'm just saying it's a factor.
Sure.
And by the way, and so I'm going to have to, Dallas, thanks so much. Let me just leave this last thought though before I say goodbye to you. Tell your children the truth about marijuana, mental illness, and violence. That's the name of the book I had in mind. Tell your children the truth about marijuana. So the book's title is Tell Your Children. Subtitle is The Truth About Marijuana, Mental Illness, and Violence. So just something to keep in mind. Hey, thank you, Dallas. Yeah, thank you so much. I appreciate your call and the circumstance you're in. It's a tough situation. Well, thank you for spending time with me this hour. I'm Greg Kokel for Sandal Reason. Give a minute. Bye-bye now.